Numbers 31 through 33, and sometime if you have a good comment or question to ask, feel free to do it. If you ask a question, just make sure I know the answer before. So we don't want to make the teacher look bad. But Numbers 31, as the chapter opens, and I'm reading from the New American Standard, a 1995 version, but it says, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take full vengeance for the sons of Israel on the Midianites, and afterward you will be gathered to your people. And Moses spoke to the people, saying, arm men from among you for the war, that they may go against Midian to execute the Lord's vengeance on Midian." Now, why is it, you know, this text doesn't explain the connection. What is it Midian has done in context that leads to this? Okay. Numbers 25, it first mentions is the daughters of Moab. But we also see that Midianite women were involved, as Laura stated. We find that one of the men brought a Midianite woman in verse 6 in plain sight of the congregation. One man brings her to his tent in full plans to involve himself in sexual sin, and they are killed in this process by Phinehas, a son of Eleazar. But God says in chapter 25, verse 16, God says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, be hostile to the Midianites and strike them, for they have been hostile to you with their tricks." They've been hostile to you, and you be hostile to them. The punishment fits the crime, lex talionis. And so you see that right at the beginning. But isn't it interesting, though? Think about this just a moment. The Lord says, you take full vengeance. And they're going to get 1,000 people from each tribe who are going to go and fight in this battle, in this conflict. The Lord is controlling life and death. He could have struck them dead if He wanted. Or He could have sent a plague among the Midianites to destroy them. But God tells His people, you fight this battle. And maybe as they fight that battle and they kill the Midianites, this is a graphic and sometimes painful reminder of the seriousness of sin and the seriousness of trying to seduce God's people. You know, Laura was mentioning they tried to get the people of Israel to worship their gods and to commit adultery. When people worshiped other gods in Israel, they were committing fornication and adultery, often figuratively and literally. Figuratively, because the people were supposed to be married to God, who was their true husband, and any disloyalty to Him in serving another god was viewed as adultery. The book of Hosea will demonstrate that in the first three chapters. But often involved in worshiping other gods was also physical acts of fornication. For these gods were often fertility gods. And you can understand then part of the appeal to the people of Israel. But getting the big picture of the chapter, don't want to lose that. And feel free to pull me back in if I do lose that. That the Midianites have led Israel to sin. God says, execute your vengeance on them. And they have 1,000 men, verses 4 through 6 of Numbers 31. 1,000 men from each of the tribes is selected to go to battle. Also, in verse 6, they bring the holy vessels. The holy vessel. It may have been the Ark of the Covenant that was brought to the battle. And they bring the trumpets for the alarm. The trumpets were mentioned back in Numbers 10, in verses 9 and 10. Those silver trumpets, when they went to battle, they would sound them. They sounded an alarm on the trumpets. And this is a reason. That you may be remembered before the Lord your God and be saved from your enemies. In a sense, these trumpets were dramatized prayers as the people sounded them, begging God for assistance against their foes. Even when God has called them to go to battle, to execute His vengeance, there is a reminder that they only win those battles by His power. In verse 6 or verse 7 says that as they go into battle, they're to do just as the Lord commanded. Just as the Lord commanded. A note that will appear quite frequently in Numbers 31. But among those they killed in verse 5, in verse 8, they killed the five kings of Midian, and also Balaam. Now, let me just ask you, and I know this is a difficult question. Look at those names of the five kings. Do you recognize any of them from elsewhere? I want to tell you, in my case anyway, cross-references in the Bible are a great tool sometimes to remind you of things that are easy to forget. Did any of you see any of the names that looked familiar? That name, Zur, you see that? In verse 8, one of these kings was named Zur. Look back at Numbers 25. Numbers 25. When the Bible talks about the Midianite woman who committed adultery, in verse 15, the name of the Midianite woman who was slain was Cozbi, the daughter of Zur. So, this king, his daughter specifically, was involved in this particular sin. And he is among those five that are killed. Also present among those that are killed is Balaam. Balaam in verse 8 and in verse 16, behold, these calls, and we'll come back to this verse later, these calls the sons of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor, so the plague was among the congregation of the Lord. Now, as Mike was teaching and Keith were teaching in Numbers, and you had Numbers 22 through 24, Balaam is trying to curse the people of Israel because he wants the reward, and the Lord is not letting him curse the people, but instead he ends up blessing the people. But Balaam's name is not in Numbers 25. It's not there. But here we find that after Balaam could not get God to curse Israel, he gets Israel to curse God. He is behind this plan to try to get the Midianite and Moabite women to commit adultery with the Israelite men and to get them to worship other gods. It is always easier. It's always easier for somebody like a Balaam to get God's people to turn on God than it is to get God to turn on his people. God is a God of faithfulness and reliability, and God is a steadfast God, and we can count on his loyalty to us. But are we loyal to him? And I want you to also think about this. There's a New Testament passage in Revelation 2 and verse 14 where Jesus is speaking to the church at Pergamum. And he says this, Revelation 2:14, "I have a few things against you. I have a few things against you, because you have there some who hold to the teaching of Balaam, who kept teaching Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit acts of immorality." Now, some people wonder, why does he talk about those who want people to commit adultery and to worship idols? Why does he connect that with Balaam? Well, the reason is because of these passages in Numbers 31, verse 8, and especially Numbers 31, verse 16. We find that behind all those crimes in Numbers 25, Balaam was present. Balaam was present. And as was going to be said later in our class today, be sure your sin will find you out. Balaam tries to get Israel to do this, but he eventually is killed in this raid. But God says, getting the big picture, take full vengeance on the Midianites. Take full vengeance on them. And Israel goes down to battle and they take vengeance on the Midianites. Do you remember in this list in Numbers 31, how many men did Israel lose in this conflict? Zero. Zero, Mike says. Back in Numbers 31, verse 49, no man of us is missing. Not one man did they lose in the conflict. So they go to battle, they don't lose anybody, they're totally victorious over the foe, and they kill all the men and originally bring back the women and bring back the children. And Moses is angry, and there are quite a few references, and Mike asked about that. But there are quite a few references to Moses' anger in this chapter. In verse 14, Moses was angry with the officers of the army. And one of the reasons he's angry, they've brought back these women alive. And some of these women were the ones that were very ones that committed adultery with the Israelite men. And so what they do, they kill everyone in Midian. Everyone. Except the women who have never been with men. That is a severe penalty. But this is the God who gave them life. Did you have a question, Mike, or thought?
It's odd that they didn't kill the women, the very ones that yeah. They made their adultery. But in verse 7, so they made war against Midian just as the Lord had commanded Moses, and they killed every male. Do we get the sense that the command was to kill everyone, or
well, the fact that Moses becomes angry at them at verse 14 tells me, it does say they made war against them as the Lord commanded. But that phrase may modify the first part about making war with them and not the second part, you know, because Moses does become angry at them. Or it could have been simply that they were to conclude that and that all of that has not been spelled out, but it will be spelled out when they don't obey. But I want to tell you something I think is interesting. You know, this is a holy war in the sense they didn't take this up on their own. The Lord said, take this up. This is the Lord's vengeance in verse 3. We've already noticed in verse 49, they don't lose a man in this process. And yet still, In verse 19, the Bible says, camp outside the camp 7 days. This is when they're greeting those that have come back to from the battle. Whoever has killed any person or whoever has touched any slain, purify yourselves, you and your captives, on the 3rd day and on the 7th day. Now, Numbers 19, when you all were talking about that, being defiled by a dead body was one of the most severe forms of defilement in the law. And you had to be sprinkled with clean water on both the 3rd day and the 7th day in order to purify it. And here, even when they have taken lives, at God's command, they are still considered unclean for taking these lives, and they have to be purified to re-enter the camp. Now, I'll tell you a conclusion I draw from that is even when life is taken at God's command, it is a very profound thing, it is a serious thing that does not need to be viewed trivially. It's trivial. Maybe that's the way I should just say it. It's trivial. And let me illustrate. And I know sometimes when discussions come up like this, there may be circumstances in our mind that make us very heated. And I know that. I understand that. Particularly if it somehow has touched us personally. But when we talk about capital punishment, is capital punishment biblical? Is it not biblical? I do think that it is biblical in Romans 13, Romans 12 and Romans 13. But I would say this. Sometimes I've heard discussions in this, and I can remember hearing this one time in a Bible class. And I was visiting at a place. I was visiting the congregation I grew up, and I don't remember if I talked to the person who said this, but I know I talked to the teacher. And I said, that was out of line. In the discussion of capital punishment, he uses the term, fry them. I do believe life should be taken in some cases. But we must understand what a profound thing life is. And what a profound thing it is to take a human life. We don't want to have the same callousness toward life that led those people to take lives. You know, we can't be guilty of that crime. But in a lot of what you see in chapter 31, you see the role of Moses, you see the role of Eleazar the priest, the successor to Aaron, and you see the dividing of spoil. And Mike has a good chart here that talks about the dividing of the spoil. And Mike asked the question, what does the division of the booty teach us? The division of spoil, what does that teach us? What does it teach us? Mike has got an answer. Your wife's name was Judy, and your name again was?
Jerry.
Okay. I was going to say John because I knew it was a J. I didn't make that association in my mind, but go ahead.
All of God's people were provided for.
Okay. All of them were provided for. Okay, very good. Jerry. Mike, you also had something. Was it the same or? Yes. Yes.
And all the spoils that go along with that is God's making provisions for miracles.
I'll tell you something else that hit me too. In what you all say, of course, is right. But the people have to remember, even in this, to be conscious of giving to God. And in every time we give to God, it is a reminder that everything we have is from Him. Everything we have is from him. And if you give a little, if you give a lot, it's first of all, it's a continual reminder. If we have a little, we give a little. If we have a lot, we give a lot. But it's always a reminder that that God is the source of all our blessings. And God is the one who gives us everything. And so very good, very good. And in the rest of the chapter, a lot of it deals with that division of the spoil among the people. And again, they do as the Lord commanded. Were there parts of Numbers 31 that I left uncommented upon? I want to pace myself here because we may not get to finish the whole thing if I don't. But is there anything, Mike?
Aside from God making all those provisions, I love the fact that, question 3, that the officers then recognize it and they give back to God.
Okay,
They are now turning around and giving that back. So when we recognize what God has given us, we ought to then show a thanksgiving and give right back in abundance.
And what can we give to God that God hasn't first given to us? I mean, that's pretty all-inclusive, isn't it? I mean, everything we have is from him. Now, do we have a marker here for the board?
Yeah, underneath the podium.
Okay, underneath the podium. Okay. Now, some of you, and I could ask Jackson or Cassie or Kennedy, and they could all fill this in. And but this, as all of you can recognize, this is the Holy Land, and this is the Mediterranean Sea, and this is the Jordan River, and this is what was known as the Sea of Galilee in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, it's not called by that. It's it's a Dead Sea. And over here are the area of the tribes, Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh. Now, how did this happen that Israel is sent to conquer this area, and yet you have three tribes that end up over here on the east of the Jordan? How does that happen? Well, Numbers 32 tells that story. Now, what I find interesting, every time I look at this, I'm reminded of this. I tend to forget it in between those times. I just put Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh up here. Do you know Manasseh isn't mentioned till we get to verse 33? And it's over and over it's said to be Reuben and Gad who are saying this. Now, Reuben was the oldest son of Jacob. Remember that? Oldest son of Jacob. He's mentioned first in verse 1. Reuben and Gad. After that, every time, Gad is mentioned first. Like in verse 2, Gad and the sons of Reuben. It's Gad always mentioned first. Now, this is what I take from that. I take it that there's no tribe that's more vocal in this than Gad. You know, that I take it that they're the ones that are really interested in this. But let's explain what's going on. In verses 1 through 5, they come to Moses. And by the way, a detour here. Who had been the kings who had been in this area that Israel had defeated? Moab was in this territory, but Sihon and Og had been in this specific area. The Moabites were around here, the Ammonites were around here, the Edomites were in this area, but Sihon and Og had controlled this area. They defeated them in Numbers 21 by God's power, by God's might, and so as a result of that, now these tribes are coming to Moses and they're saying to Moses, listen, this is ideal for raising livestock here on this side. And we have much livestock. We have many herds and many flocks. And we propose that when an inheritance is given to us among the tribes, that we dwell on this side of the Jordan. Now, to show you that this was good area for raising livestock, let me play a little word association with you. In the Old Testament, the top flight bulls were bulls of Bashan. Bashan in this area here, okay? Hey, this is a good area for grazing livestock, for raising herds, raising flocks. And the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh are saying, listen, we want over here. What's Moses' first response to that? Yeah, he's angry. He's upset about this. And why is he angry?
They need to fight him in.
It seems like to him, this is a repetition of the sin of the unfaithful spies. The unfaithful spies in Numbers 13 and 14 says the land is good. It is a productive land, but the cities are walled. The inhabitants are too strong. We cannot take the land. They lack the faith to go in and take what God told them to do. And Moses really is angry at this. He says, you're repeating the same sin of Numbers 13 and 14. Did you have a comment, brother?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, and I will say, a lot of the language that comes in conquering Sihon and Og, particularly when you read Deuteronomy 2:24 to Deuteronomy 3:11, a lot of that language is intentionally worded in a way, the same things, the same lack of faith that prevented them from fighting, going into the land and taking Canaan in Numbers 13 and 14, God overcame in Deuteronomy 2 and 3. I don't know if I worded that. That was a sentence with all kinds of tangents in it. But if you have any kind of question about what I said, feel free to... Exactly. That's what I was trying to say. They're fortified cities. And also the fact that the inhabitants were so big and they were giants. Remember Og's bed, how big Og's bed was. I mean, they overcame these things through faith in God. But Moses is upset about this. Now, Reuben and Gad say, listen, you're misunderstanding us. We're not saying we won't go fight for our brothers. We're going to go fight for our brothers. And we're going to clear out all this land so that our brothers can take possession. We're just saying we want to build cities here. We want to raise livestock here. And we will leave our families behind. But we will go with our brothers. And we will go before them and fight for the land of Israel. That's what they respond in verse 16 through 19 of Numbers 32. Now, I've always wondered, was that their intention from the start? I don't know. It may have been, but it may not have been. But Moses becomes angry at them, and he says, and they say, no. They said, we'll go in, we'll fight for our brothers, but we just want, after our brothers have their inheritance, us to receive our inheritance on this side of the Jordan. Do the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh keep that commitment? They do keep that commitment. In Joshua 1, verses 12 through 18, we find that they kept that commitment, that Joshua speaks to them and says, remember what you promised Moses? And they said, yes, we will obey you just as we obeyed Moses. And you remember when they come back, in Joshua 22, that they build an altar. And they build an altar not for burnt offering or for sacrifices, but as a reminder to the sons of Israel that there's unity between you over here on this side of the Jordan and us over here on that side of the Jordan. Joshua 22, great account one that sometimes we ignore. But Moses says, okay. He says, if that's your intention, if your intention is to go and to fight for your brothers and to make sure they possess the land, then good. Then you can have this land to possess. But if you don't, it is a sin. And your sin will find you out, as verse 23 says. You're going to be held accountable for this particular sin, this particular wrongdoing. And so there is agreement between the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh in this regard. As I said, Manasseh doesn't appear till we get to verse 33. And in verse 33, Manasseh appears. But then you see in verse 34 through 36, the cities Gad built. Then 37, 38, the cities that Reuben built. And 39 through 42, cities that Manasseh built. Now, that was a pretty quick overview of that. What questions? Yes.
Military wise, strategically, it would be good for them to be on that side of Jordan, because even further east of them is this vast desert that is impossible to get through and keep all your soldiers alive. So since this funnel point right here, which is Israel, get through down to Egypt and the African continent.
Are you saying it would have been advantage for them to be
on
over here?
Sides.
Yeah. Oh, on both sides. Okay. Yeah. Yes.
So now this funnel point, which is going to become the nation of Israel, there's not going to be an easy pass on either side.
Okay. Okay, that's a good point to make. Very good point to make, and a very interesting point. They do. We've already mentioned before that you have groups, and I'm trying to go here in sequence, like the Ammonites. Were Ammonites, Moabites, Edomites, it would have been in this area. But for them to be on this side would have increased the presence of Israel's enemies all around them. So from that standpoint, this is to their advantage. And that is exactly right. I would also say, though, that because these tribes are geographically separated by the Jordan, often that made them a little bit more easy pickings for enemies. Jephthah, the judge, is from this area. And remember, Jephthah was dealing with the Ammonites who were right around here. But also in 2 Kings 15, let me look at the exact verse. But in 2 Kings chapter 15, that what we see is when the people were taken to Assyrian captivity, that some of these areas suffered first. It's 2 Kings 15, verse 29, that shows. Do some of you remember from freshman Bible days, what year did Israel go into Assyrian captivity? What was that? 722. Okay. Laura, she was a good student of mine in freshman Bible. But anyway, 722. But this with Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh, this happens around 732, so they seem to have been taken to captivity a little bit earlier than some of the other tribes. So often their position, I do think it is a blessing to Israel, like you're stating, but at the same time it often made them more vulnerable. And so, what else? Yeah.
And I made the analogy with Laura. It's like, I hate to use this as a, but it's close as I'm going to get. If you go on to take your kids, we're going to go to Disneyland. And on your way there, they want to stop at Pennington. They want to stay at the Pennington.
experienced. Mm-hmm. So God had planned for them this promised land of milk and honey.
Yes.
Yes. Everything you can possibly need, God is providing, in you want to settle over here on this side. And that's why God got so, and one of the reasons why Moses got so angry, not just that you're going to discourage the rest of the sons of Israel, but you're not wanting to go into the land that God has promised Abraham, Isaac, and you're not wanting to go there.
Yes. Yes, I understand what you're saying, and it doesn't seem like these were the original confines of the promised land at all. There is a statement, look at Numbers 32, 31. It said, the sons of Gad, the sons of Reuben, answered saying, as the Lord has said to your servants, so we will do. As the Lord has said. It wasn't originally part of the land of promise, as Mike states. Wasn't part of the original plan, but at the same time, it does seem that either Moses, in his role as a prophet, was speaking for God, or the people inquired of God, and they allow this. So while it wasn't originally part of the promise, it does seem to expand the promised land. And ultimately, you remember, they're given three cities of refuge on both sides of the Jordan, as Joshua 20 will talk about. So good thoughts. Now, Numbers 33 talks about all the places Israel encamped when they crossed the Jordan. And let me just give you a little of this. I'm going to use a little bit more board here, but from Numbers 33, verses 3 through 18, these tell of events that happened and that are recorded from Exodus 12 to Numbers 12. Exodus 12 to Numbers 12. Now, when we start in the latter part of verse 18 through verse 36, we have no parallels in Exodus through Numbers. So it gives us some place names that we don't see specifically mentioned. Some of these place names mentioned in verses 31 through 33, these verses, Deuteronomy 10, 6 and 7 later seems to echo the names of some of these places. So, and then the final part, Numbers 33, verses 37 through 49. These parts have some connection with some events in Numbers 20 through 22. Now, We read a chapter like Numbers 33 with all these details and all these places they camped, and we say, what is the purpose of this being in the Bible? One of the things I think it shows us to view these experiences as historical. Now, I recognize that some of you may have no questions about that. When the Bible says it happened, you believe it happened. And I think that's what we should believe. But I think the mentioning, he says Moses was careful to record all these things, and he mentions all these places, and he alludes to some details that we've seen before. It tells us how carefully they were keeping history as they traveled through the wilderness. The Bible is not a once-upon-a-time fairy tale. It is a carefully chronicled history. Also, it gives us, in some cases, it gives us a better chronological framework. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, when we're in Numbers chapter 20, Numbers 20 in verse 22, the Bible says, when the sons of Israel set out from Kadesh, the sons of Israel, the whole congregation came to Mount Hor. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron at Mount Hor, the border of the land of Edom. Aaron shall be gathered to his people. He shall not enter the land which I have given to the sons of Israel. And the Bible tells us, there's a reference, I believe, and I'm not seeing it presently, but in Numbers 20, verses 22 through 29, there's a reference somewhere to that being in the first month that Aaron died. The first month. But Aaron's death is stated to be in the first month, but it doesn't specifically read. It's Numbers 20, verse 1. You're right. When Miriam dies, that's right. Numbers 20, verse 1, that it says that. But here we find specifically it was the first month of the 40th year. First month of the 40th year. You know what that tells us? Everything from Numbers 20 to Deuteronomy, end of Deuteronomy and Moses' sermons, takes place in 1 year. That is a lot of revelation concentrated in a short period of time. But tell you what else it does. This list in Numbers 33 is a reminder of Israel's sins. A reminder of Israel's sins. For example, in Numbers 33, verses 7 and 8, Numbers 33, verses 7 and 8, the Bible talks about the Israel journeyed from Etham and came to Pi Hahiroth. And it talks about how they passed through the midst of the sea. But remember when they saw the Egyptians coming, they said, why did you bring us out to die in the wilderness? Why didn't you listen to what we said? Leave us alone that we may die in the land of Egypt. It's better for us to die in Egypt than to come out into this wilderness. And many of these events will recall Israel's complaining and murmuring. Many of these events, it doesn't mention their sin specifically, but it's a reminder of that. It's a reminder of these places were places of failure, but also it is a reminder of God's grace to the people. At place after place where they sinned and where they fell short. And God didn't give up on those people. It's amazing. When you see what a murmuring, complaining, backbiting people Israel was in the wilderness, and God doesn't give up on them. And they complain about a lack of water, and they complain about a lack of food, and they complain about having the same food over and over again. And God continues to provide, continues to care. Oh, He rebukes them. But He doesn't give up on them. And I think that's a value of this as well. And I have some specific instances, for example, like you look at verse 16. Verse 16, they journeyed from the wilderness of Sinai and camped at Kibroth Hattaavah. Do you remember what happens there? That's where the people say in Numbers 11, we are tired of this manna. We loathe this manna. Give us meat to eat. And God sends quail in great abundance. And the people eat quail. But some of those, I take it, those who led in the complaint, are struck dead while eating the quail. Some of them are. It shows us both God's judgment on sin and God's mercy at not giving up on the people of Israel as a whole. And just so many things like that are illustrated in Numbers 33. And I sent Brother Al my notes, which you're welcome to send to anyone who's interested, about 60-something pages of notes on various, on the whole book of Numbers, not just this section, okay? But notice how this closes. Look at verse 50. The Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you cross over the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you. Destroy all their figured stones, destroy all their molten images, demolish all their high places. You shall take possession of the land and live in it, for I have given the land to you to possess it. You shall inherit the land by lot according to your families. To the larger you shall give more inheritance, to the smaller you shall give less inheritance. Whatever the lot falls to anyone, that shall be his. You shall inherit it according to the tribes of your fathers. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of a land from before you, then it will come about that those whom you let remain of them will become as pricks in your eyes and thorns in your side, and they shall trouble you in the land in which you live. And it shall come about that as I plan to do to them, so I will do to you. You're going to have to drive out the people who live in this land, or they're going to be trouble to you, and they're going to lead you away from me. Any final questions as we close? God bless you guys. It's great that y'all been willing to study this book, and it's a blessing. I know that for Mike to teach it, but may just keep on studying the Word.